And I guess we should probably just, we're just going to give like a short intro really, and kind of say a bit about the idea of the symposium, how we kind of got round to putting it together. And we thought we'd basically just go through some of the terms, the kind of key terms in the title, which I'm standing in front of. So the Islands Unchained thing was the kind of best of a terrible bunch of hideous puns that we'd gone through when trying to come up with a name for the symposium, which I think started out with Palace of the Peacrop in homage to Wilson Harris.
It's a pretty select niche joke that we thought wouldn't play very well with most audiences. It might reemerge at a later stage. Then in a shameless attempt to kind of hitch our wagon to the cinematic zeitgeist that was a few months ago, we thought, Mangoes Unchained. Again, it just sounded too offensive to go with. We thought about Lovelace and the novel Salt, which I'm going to talk very briefly about in a few minutes, and the lead character, Uncle Bango. We thought, could we do Bango Unchained? And then in the end, we kind of stepped off that and settled for the somewhat more prosaic but probably more sensible
Islands Unchained. Although we kind of fully appreciate, we've called it Islands, but obviously, we take the Caribbean to mean that kind of much wider sort of other America, expanded Caribbean area, kind of encompassing the Guyanas, even parts of Brazil up through kind of into Central America. So, despite the kind of the islands reference, we're thinking kind of pan-Caribbean regional scope.
Yeah. It's a good caveat to sleep. Yeah. So I'm going to start by just flagging up this wonderful novel by Earl Lovelace, published in 1996, Salt, which I think is a good place for us to start in our thoughts today. It's Lovelace's really magisterial epic of Caribbean history. And it opens, those of you that know the text, it opens with the principal narrator, at least for the first part of the novel, recounting the stories that he hears from his paternal uncle, Bango. And in this section, Bango gives his listeners a reading of the history of the modern Caribbean. And in doing so, he really touches upon this idea of the environmental experience of the region and illustrates what we can see as the contradictory dynamics of the socio-ecological history of the archipelago. It's a remarkable opening to a novel in any case. And Bango's history lesson is a combination of tracing family personal lineages, wider fables, and remembering the processes of colonization in the Caribbean. And the novel dramatizes this act of remembering the processes of colonization in the Caribbean with a kind of wonderfully ironic adoption or inhabitation of the colonizer's burden. In this moment in the novel, Bango inhabits the colonizer's worldview for his audience. The problem of colonialism, he tells us, the problem of colonialism in the Caribbean was how to keep people in captivity against every natural urge. So on the one hand, the landscape in Salt provides a focus for articulating a history of emancipation. Bango says, watch the landscape of this island, and you know that they could have never hold people here surrendered to unfreedom. The sky, the sea, every green leaf and tangle of vines sing freedom. And Bango then goes on to explain how the landscape of many islands provided as well a very real site for resistance, recuperation and rebellion for maroon societies and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, in the same disquisition, he reveals that the very landscape and the climate itself seem implicated, even complicit, in the enactment of domination. For colonial rulers, it was, quote, it was so hot, they had to get people to fan them. People had to carry swords. People had to carry cushions for them to sit down. They had to get people to beat people for them, people to dish out lashes. So here we get the beginnings of an understanding of the contradictory dynamics of the socio-ecological history in the region that we want to explore today. And this is, for us, a productive paradigm. It offers us ways to think through the history of the Caribbean, drawing primarily on conceptualizations of world ecology, which Mike is going to say a little bit about, and the study of commodity frontiers and foodways as a basis for opening up new kinds of literary comparativism.
Yeah, so sorry about that text. That was one of the speakers asking where they could park, but find somewhere. Yeah, so we've been kind of very much sort of influenced by the environmental historian Jason Moore's ideas of world ecology, and that's in a sense where we're taking the idea of kind of commodity frontiers from. And in particular, Moore kind of talks about the way in which the capitalist world system emerges through socio-ecological relations. It's not so much, it doesn't, you know, capitalism or other kind of civilizational histories don't act upon nature. They emerge through the knitting together of human and extra-human relations within definite kind of historical relations. And his idea in particular of the commodity frontier is something through which capitalism has emerged, and his emphasis on the crisis-ridden logic of the commodity frontier, that capitalism emerges through the kind of the crisis-ridden logic of commodity frontiers, their booms and busts, the way in which they hop from region to region, kind of searching out new ecological surpluses, which they kind of mine to the point of exhaustion, and then have to jump onto the next kind of free zone. That idea of crisis is kind of played a big role in kind of thinking about the idea of Islands Unchained, and obviously sort of took us to Brathwaite, as Kamaya Brathwaite, as someone who's obviously theorised quite heavily the idea of kind of crisis and catastrophe. And I was reading through Brathwaite's essay Namsetor and the Companion Stranger. There's a brilliant section in that titled History of Nam. And Nam in Brathwaite's work is this kind of complex, multivalent concept that kind of means something like the irreducible spirit of a culture. The word's Brathwaite's own coinage, although he sort of derives it from a series of diverse sources, including the Dogon term Nomo, meaning creative force or ancestral spirit, the name of the Akan sky god Nyam, and the Wolof and Fula term Nyam, meaning eat. And in his notes to Mother Poem, Brathwaite refers to Nam as secret name, soul source, connected with Nyam, eat, yam, root food, Nyam, name of God. Nam, he continues, is the heart of our nation language, which comes into conflict with the cultural imperial authority of Prospero. And so you can see already in highly compressed form, you know, Brathwaite's kind of given an indication, the kind of connections that we're interested in this symposium, that link between cultural practices, cultural forms, foodstuffs and modes of subsistence, language and political conflict and resistance. And so in the History of Nam section in the Namsetor essay, Brathwaite not only fleshes out these connections, but he also kind of places them in a world historical context. He begins talking about, he's going to talk about the American Revolution. He says kind of around 1776, on the Caribbean plantation, there comes this opportunity for what he calls a revitalization of Nam. And he kind of notes the way that up until American independence, the plantation authorities tended to severely delimit the amount of food grown on the estates, so as to ensure maximum time and space could obviously be given over to the production of cash crops. And so a lot of the food, you know, for the enslaved was imported from the North American colonies. And such restrictions on the ability of the enslaved to produce their own food were not only, says Brathwaite, a device to earn the maximum from sugar, but also a way of denying what he calls the nourishing arts of cultivation and, by extension, culture. But above all, he argues, and this is it's written in kind of Brathwaite's characteristic Sycorax style, but he talks about it was a way to monitor and delimit the slave's strength, energy, protein intake, diet. So that on the slave plantations, one of the reasons why there are relatively, but only relatively, few effective slave revolts in the period before 1776, for example, it's because the slaves, without their own food plots, just didn't have enough time, energy left over to plot the regime far less rebellious. And then he talks about kind of marinage as being comparatively more successful because of the control over food supplies. And then Brathwaite goes on to observe how during the American War of Independence, because naval blockades reduced North American food shipments into the Caribbean, and this, combined with a persistent drought and a series of hurricanes, led to a widespread famine in which even it's just in Jamaica alone, some 15,000 slaves died. And still within this catastrophe, and this is a kind of, you know, sort of signature move of in Brathwaite's thought, just as it is for a number of other kind of Caribbean thinkers like Wilson Harris. Within this catastrophe, says Brathwaite, germinate the seeds of potential transformation. And he goes on to talk about how, after the problems that came with the American Revolution and the War of Independence, there's an immediate disruption of the mercantilist system with all its global arrangements. resulting in alarming and widespread starvation throughout the British plantations under the threat of the collapse of the system. And so the momentous decision was taken. See, for example, the Jamaican Acts of 1781, regularising the introduction of yam, naki, mango, the breadfruit, etc., to permit, allow, encourage, legalise, in fact, the growing of slave food by slaves with land, plots and time, weekends provisioned for this. So this is a kind of this is the kind of mangoes unchained moment, right? This is the kind of the unchained of yams, breadfruit, and so on. And in alongside that, the kind of proliferation of revolts and rebellions in the early 19th century. And so, you know, Brathwaite's making this connection between food plots and the seditious plotting of the enslaved. And so, in a way, that's what we're interested in, right? This those two meanings of plot, the agrarian and the political. That Brathwaite plays on, and also adding in, obviously, a third, the plot as a narrative device. How are plots and plots plotted, if you like? You know, it's how are they encoded in literary works? And it's just worth emphasising, when we speak of plots, whether it's the, you know, the plotting of the enslaver, indeed the indentured, or the poor and the powerless more generally, you can kind of identify two tendencies here. On the one hand, there's that kind of the eruptive volcanic plotting of the, you know, the rebellion, the spectacular violence of the slave revolt. On the other, there's that kind of underground plotting, the, you know, the use of subversion, mimicry, playing dumb, camouflage, all those kinds of, you know, the Anansi figure, the trickster figure, that kind of plotting. And obviously those two are, you know, closely connected, you know, dialectically bound. And in a sense, you can, to kind of come back to the Bango point about, you know, watch the landscape of this island, and you know they could have never held people here surrendered to unfreedom. Yeah, I think you can kind of see the landscape in a sense as providing something like an objective correlative for those two meanings of plot. On the one hand, there's the eruptive volcanic topographies of the Caribbean archipelago, the earthquake cracked landscapes, you know, the effulgent vegetation. That's perhaps this kind of objective correlative for that kind of volcanic sense of resistance. On the other hand, there's the kind of the submarine unity of the region, you know, its underwater coralline connections, the geological subsurface continuations. So in that sense, the archipelago's geography and the long history of resistance to which its landscape has borne witness, to paraphrase Edward Gleeson, whose term archipelago aesthetics we've borrowed from. Those two, that geography and that history, are inextricably linked. I think that's what Chris is going to end.
Yeah, just a couple of fairly brief thoughts on the idea of archipelago aesthetics. One way to get us started thinking about all of this is to recall the various complementary, sometimes contradictory ways in which the Caribbean archipelago has been imagined or poetically rendered. The chain of islands running from Florida down to Venezuela. But even if we just limit ourselves to 20th century imaginings of this kind of cartographic space, the catalogue of commentators who've attempted with varying degrees of sympathy and accomplishment to offer a kind of poetic metaphor for the island chain is a long one. To start with, we might recall the infamous statement, "Between Europe and America, I see only specks of dust." Attributed to Charles de Gaulle on a state visit to Martinique in 1964, as if the largely volcanic geological natural history, all that eruptive potential and all the human and extra-human complexity of the Caribbean can be reduced to the kind of insignificant subparticles, motes of ash dust drifting in space. I've not actually been able to nail down the original quotation to de Gaulle, so if anybody knows where I can find that, I'd be very appreciative. But it's often quoted by others. Gleeson, for example, is where I found it. So alongside de Gaulle, perhaps we might consider the very first paragraph of Patrick Lee Fermor's account of his travels around the region in 1950. Geographically, the Caribbean archipelago is easy to split up into component groups. With the exception of an occasional coral island like Barbados, the islands are the emerging summits of a range of drowned volcanoes, a submarine continuation of the same geological upheaval as the Andes, and on the map they swing northwards from the South American continent like the dislocated vertebrae of a spinal column based upon the os coccyx of Trinidad. Now, Fermor's whole account the Traveller's Tree is suffused with classical allusion. It's dripping in classical, mythological and historical relation. And we're constantly reminded as we read the account of the author's first true archipelagic love, the Hellenic islands of the Mediterranean. It's as if in writing this travelogue, Patrick Leigh Fermor can't quite leave the Mediterranean behind. But the opening paragraph is, I think, rather suggestive. It identifies what we understand as the expanded Caribbean, what Mike was talking about, that ring of mountain ranges that is more than just the islands of the Caribbean Sea. He points, in effect, to the same submarine unity identified by Brathwaite in that passage. And yet, the overriding impression that Fermor's image conjures is one of fracture and dismemberment. In his somatic rendering of the island chain, the image of a kind of skeletal frame registers at some level the notion of a history of violence. It also, of course, emphasises mortality, the vulnerability of the human form, perhaps also famine, if we push it further. It signals a violence borne by human bodies and by landscapes. It's as if the skeleton of island backbones has been kind of uncovered by a careful archaeologist and kind of dusted off and is left there, lying on the earth, kind of fixed and fairly desiccated. And we might compare this image of the island chain with Césaire's from Notebook, where he talks about an archipelago arched in a kind of anxious but maternal protection of the Caribbean Sea. It's worth noting, given our interests today, that Fermor also proffers his own take on the necessary aesthetic response to the archipelago as well. He says, a few sentences on, "Only a haphazard, almost picaresque approach can suggest the peculiar mood and tempo of the Caribbean and the turbulent past from which they spring." And I suppose one of the things we're keen to explore today is the ways in which this socio-ecological history, these bundles of human and extra-human nature in dialectical unity, can be related in ways through forms of cultural production that aren't haphazard. How do we escape this kind of curse of the picaresque, as Fermor seems certain that it is necessary? Of course, there are a myriad other ways in which the island chains have been represented, and I won't go into them in any detail now, but just for your kind of enjoyment, I suppose. We have Walcott in his poem, "Star Apple Kingdom." What was the Caribbean? A green pond mantling behind the great house columns of Whitehall, behind the Greek facades of Washington, with bloated frogs squatting on lily pads like islands. Islands that coupled as sadly as turtles engendering islets, as the turtle of Cuba mounting Jamaica engendered the Caymans, as behind the hammerhead turtle of Haiti, San Domingo, trailed the little turtles from Tortuga to Tobago. So a very different kind of rendering. And we might hold that up against another one of Walcott's envisagings of the islands from his Nobel Prize winning essay, The Antilles, Fragments of Epic Memory. I always get that wrong. Where he visualises the Caribbean Sea as a swimming pool. The islands are inflatable plastic cocktail rafts, and the languid foot of America, the Floridan foot, dangles in the swimming pool, which offers another kind of possible reading. And then finally, to finish with Brathwaite's poem, Calypso, which I'm not going to read out, but we'll perhaps leave up for a few minutes as we move into the next paper. I don't think there's anything else to say at this stage, is there? Other than at the end of the session, we factored in time for a roundtable discussion, which we hope we'll have with wine, and then we'll be going on to have dinner at Shanana's on campus, which promises much, but doesn't always deliver. Everybody is welcome to join us. We can't, of course, pay for everybody, but we'd love to see you there if you make it through the day. Okay.
All right, well, I'd like to welcome our first speaker for the day, which is Lisa Parabasini-Chabert. So if we could all...
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I feel very spoiled. There's always, when I come to Warwick, a really great spirit and people who have, you know, I look upon now as friends and from whom I have learned a lot, so I'm very happy to be here. Let's see, slideshow. I have one image. So this is my full PowerPoint, as you can see here. say, here we go. This paper, I should say, is I owe to Michael. So whatever comments and questions you have.
We can't see the...
Oh,
yeah, just...
sorry.
Sorry.
I am blocking my own...
Ah,
great. Whatever comments and questions you have will help me deliver it as soon as, as possible. I want to start with a quotation from Marie Chauvet's Fond de Nègre, where she writes that all misfortune comes from the cut trees. They have cut them down, even the calabash trees, even the trees of Ogou. In Alan Lomax's compilation of Haitian music, Alan Lomax in Haiti, released in 2009 by the Smithsonian Institution, there is a song performed by Francilia, a reine chantée, or song leader in Vodou, dedicated to the loi, or spirit, of Bois Nambois, literally tree in the woods, asking him to look upon the misery his people are mired in. And I want to read a stanza from that song. I say your mother has called upon Bois Nambois. Don't you see the misery I'm going through? Oh, my mother has called upon Bozou Bois Nambois. Don't you see the misery I'm going through? Resign yourself, oh, resign yourself, adieu. Don't you see the misery I've fallen into? Francilia's plaintive Vodou song, with its poignant faith in the powers of the loi to bring succor to the wretchedness, I want to use this as a point of entry into a discussion of how Haiti's faith in Vodou, which was already threatened by the nation's severe environmental crisis, entered a period of further crisis in the wake of the January 2010 earthquake and its aftermath of death, despair, and epidemic. Her song sadly reminds us that Haiti's severe deforestation, the loss of approximately 97% of its trees, of the musician trees and sacred mapu that filled this once abundant forest and formed the natural habitat for Bois Nambois, has been the most tragic expression of the sad economic, social, and religious quandary of the nation of Haiti before the January 2010 earthquake. In the analysis that follows, I want to trace a somewhat circuitous route from Haiti's environmental predicament, or the fate of its trees, its ongoing cholera outbreak, through the crisis of faith unleashed by the January 2010 earthquake, and back to Francilia and her song to Bois Nambois, seeking to highlight the connections between Haiti's environmental crisis and the nation's foundational faith. And so essentially I'll be applying environmental theories to see how if that helps us understand the present crisis in Haiti in terms of what Michel Rotrujo had called it's been the longest neocolonial experiment in the history of the West. It is impossible, I will argue, to understand the nuances of Haiti's predicament without acknowledging the devastating role played by the too aggressive deforestation of its land in the name of the development of sugar plantations in the 18th century Caribbean and the young nation's crippling burden of foreign debt beginning in the 19th century. I'm referring to its agreement to pay an amount that was beyond the possibilities of the nation in return for official recognition from France. Deforestation, through its role in the loss of Haiti's topsoil, and with it the possibility of bringing agricultural production to anything approaching sustainability, has resulted in the nation's acute vulnerability to natural disasters and exposure to epidemic outbreaks, such as the cholera epidemic, from which thousands have died to date. I'm referring in part to the, you hear every year of this thousands of people dying in mud flows in Haiti. This is all that product of the deforestation. It's a continuous payment in terms of death coming from the fact that there are no trees to keep the mud the topsoil in place. Topsoil also, as probably you will all know, takes about 10,000 years to renew. So this is really a devastating impact. Haiti's acute deforestation illustrates materially and symbolically the close links between Haiti's history of colonialism, racism, and environmental degradation, the high levels of risk faced by its population, and the future of the religion that had guided the nation's history until January 2010. The extensive press coverage of the fate of Haiti following the January 2010 earthquake barely alluded to Haiti's environmental crisis as a contributing factor to the deepening poverty that made facing the dire emergencies brought by the earthquake such an insurmountable burden. One of the main developments that we have seen since those first months is the turning towards the environmental as a key explanation for why it has been so difficult for the nation to recover. So in that sense, we are in the right path towards understanding what has been happening in Haiti. Because it's not difficult to see how central environmental concerns are to Haiti's worsening economy and the crucial role deforestation has played in limiting the country's potential to develop a stronger economic foundation. To this, we should add that Haiti imports about 96% of the food the population consumes, and this is definitely unsustainable. The deep and vast tropical forest discovered in the Caribbean region by the 15th century European colonizers, which led to frequent descriptions of the region as Eden, had already been impacted by the indigenous population in significant ways. But the newcomers' arrival would bring radical and irrevocable changes to the environment. The almost immediate colonial assault on the Caribbean forest to build homes, to clear land for planting crops, later to plant sugarcane, was a major contribution to the ecological revolution, which Eleanor Melby describes as the abrupt and qualitative break with the process of environmental and social change that had developed in situ. So this idea of an abrupt and qualitative break, which is what happens particularly in Haiti and Hispaniola, which was the site of the first colonies in the New World. Vast portions of the coastal forest were cleared to establish settlements, as well as for fuel and ship repairs. As the first century of the European conquest progressed, wood was used in large quantities for the construction and repair of the colonizers' homes and ships, and land began to be cleared for the planting of provisions to feed a growing population. The destruction of the forest marked the beginning of the extinction of numerous species of flora and fauna, already threatened by the intensification of hunting as the principal means of providing protein for a growing European population. By far the greatest damage to the forest, however, was done by the development of the plantation economy. Throughout the Caribbean, most dramatically in Haiti, given the scope of its sugar production before the revolution, coastal mahogany forests were completely cleared to make room for sugarcane plantations. Later, we would see those mahogany forests contributing to stately homes in England, Spain, and France. Sometimes I feel that I can see exactly where the beam came from. So you should, you have something to pay for. Timber was used for housing and for the daily fuel requirements of the boiling machines in the sugar mills, even in remote mountainous areas not suited for the cultivation of cane. The Caribbean's early literature, and I'm talking about beginning with Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo, who wrote his Historia Natural de las Indias in 1524. Even in Oviedo in 1524, you already see recorded the disappearance of various species of birds and mammals and the need for severely deforested territories like Barbados to import fuel from other islands, which we know very early in the 1620s. The assault on the forest can be measured in terms of biodiversity losses that have led to the disappearance of countless tree, plant, and animal species in the region, losses that so far number in the thousands. For example, you think of Barbados, it was deforested in the 17th century, 90% deforested in the 17th century, and of course, whatever lived there lost its habitat and many species disappeared. There's only 11% of what remains in Barbados today was there at the time of the so you can see what the loss is. The burgeoning Haitian sugar planter class was not unaware of how sugarcane plantations could seriously compromise local ecologies, even as early as the early 18th century. The experience of Spanish and Portuguese sugar producers in the early cane plantations in the Canary Islands and Madeira showed that these islands were devastated in this way by the effects of deforestation for sugar cultivation as early as the 15th century. Planters were keenly aware of how plantation culture based on slave labor promoted very rapid environmental change in terms of deforestation and subsequent soil erosion, flooding, gullying, local aridification, and drying up of the streams and rivers. It's very cheerful. I'm really sorry. It's just like I'm a source of joy. Desiccation theories connecting deforestation to decreases in rainfall were avidly discussed throughout the region in the second half of the 18th century, when Haiti's sugar production accounted for nearly one-third of all French foreign trade. We see these concerns clearly evident in the writings of Martinican historian Médéric Moreau de Saint-Méry in his two books on Hispaniola, published in 1796, which explicitly noted the environmental impact of the island's too rapid deforestation, especially on the intensification of soil erosion, the reduction in rain levels, and the impact of land clearing on local animal species. In Haiti, Moreau wrote, and I quote, "The French colonies who have aided these depredations by the cultivation of coffee and by a system which counts the time to come as nothing have cut down even the trees that covered the summits of the mountains and attracted the rains, insomuch that a diminution of the rains is now perceivable in the French part, where they were formerly very considerable and regular." So this is Moreau writing, publishing in 1796. Throughout Haiti, as Moreau already gleans, compromised deforested environments would be one of the chief legacies of colonialism. The foundational ceremony of Bois Caiman, it should be noted, took place in an already severely stressed natural habitat with a much higher population density than most other Caribbean islands, with the exception perhaps of Barbados. With decreasing rainfall and a much more intensive system of plantation agriculture than any other island in the region, Haiti experienced more rapid deforestation and loss of soil fertility than any other sugar-producing island in the Caribbean. Moreau de Saint-Méry's observation on the state of the forests of Hispaniola are of particular interest to me because of the ironic backdrop they offer to one of the most salient literary traditions of Haiti, that of the celebration of the beauty and extension of the island's deep forest, which becomes a foundational element in the development of the national literature following the revolution. It is a thematic strand that emerges in Haitian poetry from the earliest literary efforts in the 19th century and includes a rich vein of poetry on the topic of Haiti's musician trees, les arbres musiciens of Haiti. Alcibiade Fleury-Battier, in his Sous les Bambous, writes of how, and I quote, "he loves the deep forest quivering with the songs of those winged birds we mistook for flowers." I love that line. And celebrates Haiti's centuries-old Mapu, the sacred trees of Haitian Vodou, in a poem in French that includes, for the first time, lines in Haitian Creole. Likewise, Massillon Kouakou, the novelist, poet, dramatist, and politician executed in 1908, writes in the poem Vin of Flo about Haiti's musician trees, and I quote, "his path vibrates in endless hymns, the wild music of the trees, of the birds, of all the voices that make up the dazzling fanfare of the forest." But this is very sad to read when you said that you can't find this forest anymore. They're writing about spaces that no longer exist. This love for the forest and delight in the coolness of its groves and musical quality of their presence stands in dramatic contrast to the rapid disappearance of the trees that Haitian novelists like Jacques Humain or Marie Chauvet will mourn in the 20th century. Le Grace Benson, likewise, writes of Haiti's urban Creole painters whose ironic visions of an earthly paradise are shaped not by their intimacy with the land, but by their alienation from it. What Benson calls, and I quote, the triple exile from paradise, from Eden, from Africa, and lastly, from family land in rural Haiti. I will return to this alienation from the land in a moment, as it is central to the alienation of the Haitian people from its loi or spirit. Following the, its successful war of independence in 1804, Haiti underwent decades of international ostracism focused almost exclusively on the race and assumed barbarism, as exemplified by their practice of vaudou, of the self-liberating slaves. Condemned by the world for its brazen revolution, Haiti was burdened by a crippling foreign debt imposed on the nation as the cost of full recognition by France. In 1825, Haiti agreed to pay 150 million francs as indemnity to the dispossessed French colonists as reparations for the property in human flesh they lost with the abolition of slavery. This was a fateful decision as the obligation was beyond the new nation's power to fulfill. It haunted Haiti's finances throughout the 19th century. The nation never missed a payment and was a contributing factor to the United States' decision to invade the nation in 1915, when its foreign debt, Haiti's foreign debt, was a staggering $21.5 million, an immense fortune then, and 80% of the government's resources were pledged to debt service. The debt, coupled with corruption and financial mismanagement by the mulatto elites, made it impossible for a succession of brief governments to invest in developing the local infrastructure and the education system, leaving the nation unable to attract the kind of foreign investment that has been crucial to other Caribbean economies. It would be impossible to estimate how many acres of precious forest resources were destroyed in order to mitigate this crippling debt, most of it to be sold in the United States, which occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1936. In the American imaginary, Haiti emerges from that occupation as a despoiled, deeply Africanized terrain inhabited by zombies and other otherworldly creatures whose population is separated from modernity by their faith in vaudou. But the occupation, with its intent, insistence on raping Haiti of its resources so it could pay its foreign debt, left the island's environment in shambles, its ecological balance in a fragile state. The occupation only reasserted the slow violence that had been perpetrated on Haiti's land and people as a resource extraction nation. What Rob Nixon, in his recent book, Slow Violence and the Environmental of the Poor, defines, and I quote, as a violence that occurs gradually and out of sight, a violence of delayed destruction that is dispersed across time and space, an attritional violence that is typically not viewed as violence at all. The slow violence of the attack on Haiti's land, however, has been of the acutest kind. It has left the viability of the nation itself and the survival of its people marked by an urgency that seemed unimaginable in continental settings until the January earthquake brought it to millions of worldwide households with access to CNN's non-stop broadcasting. It's impossible to separate, however, the painful images accessible to the world since the destruction of Port-au-Prince from an environmental crisis that has brought the rural population of the country to the edge of despair, pushing refugees towards the fertile plains of the Artibonite in Haiti's central meseta, where thousands died during the disastrous floods of 2008, and moved from there to Port-au-Prince and their catastrophic encounter with the 2010 calamity. Haiti's forests have been recent years have been cut down, the last 20 years particularly, been cut down in catastrophic numbers for the charcoal used everywhere for cooking, a result of the inability of the state to organize a distribution system for propane or any other substitute cooking fuel. So as Haiti entered the 21st century, the country's extreme deforestation, the concomitant soil erosion, droughts, and disastrous flash floods had ravaged the countryside. And then, of course, we have the earthquake. The worsening environmental conditions have, in the last two decades, pushed increasing numbers of people, as I said, into the Artibonite. given the centrality of the relationship between the land and Vodou, it is easy to understand how this process of protracted assault on the land would have important repercussions on the nature and practice of religion in Haiti. The consolidation of the revolution and the land grants to former slaves it made possible transformed Haiti into a rural nation of subsistence farmers working their small plots. This new peasantry organized itself around small villages that function as extended family compounds. Known as lacus, they opened a new space for the preservation of African-derived Creole religions. The connection between the lacus and the preservation of Vodou had important repercussions, as it meant that its rituals and practices grew out of the needs and concerns of specific communities. There is no central liturgical authority in Vodou, only a set of foundational principles and traditional rites that were allowed to adapt to the idiosyncrasies of various groups, merging and separating to accommodate the flow of peoples across the Haitian landscape. If one thing remains constant, however, is the centrality of the potomitan or center post in every unfu or temple and the connection it offers between loi, servitor, and land. In Vodou, the loi or spirit known as loco, the chief of Legba's escort, is known as he of the trees. He governs the temple or temple center post that serves as channel for the loi, the divine forces of Vodou, to enter into communion with their human servitors through the phenomenon of possession. Loco and his consort Aizan, as Maya Deren describes them in Divine Horsemen, are the moral parents of the race, the first Ungan and Mambo, priest and priestess of Vodou, whose chief responsibility is that of imparting on humans the knowledge or connaissance on which the future of the race depends. They are also Vodou's first healers, as it was Loco who discovered how to draw the properties from the trees and to make the best herbal charms against disease, and Aizan who protects against malevolent magic. Together, they represent the central belief in Vodou that spiritual maturity rests on the understanding of the necessary balance between cosmic forces and the natural world. The relationship between land, loi, and believer is perhaps most economically expressed in a 1953 painting by Toussaint Auguste called Papa Zaka en Possession in Edwige Danticat's collection of Haitian art, which is the one that you can see here. And I just wanted to talk about it very briefly because I think you'll understand, hopefully you'll understand the connection, what it means to be possessed. And Toussaint Auguste Papa Zaka en Possession, or Possessed by Papa Zaka, depicts most vividly the breach of the divide between the living and the loi that is the common goal of all sacred work in Vodou, through the need to intercede for a restoration of the land. In the painting, Auguste has turned to the loi most closely connected to the Haitian peasantry, Papa Zaka, to depict Vodou's most significant embodiment ritual, possession, within the context of Haiti's most urgent historical crisis, the severe deforestation that has rapidly destroyed the land's productivity in the small island nation. And you can see the trees all chopped and cut, and the barren mountains in the back. Papa Zaka, a peasant figure traced to Amerindian culture, is recognized by his blue denim jacket and the maku, or sisal, market sack he habitually carries. Those possessed by Papa Zaka usually don his characteristic peasant straw. So the woman is possessed, she shares the hat. And go through the motions of sowing seed. When he appears in a ceremony, he's typically offered peasant fare, boiled maize, afiba, which is stuffed pig's intestines, and glasses of clairin, the peasant distilled white rum. Auguste's paintings articulates with great simplicity and acute clarity the reciprocity of the relationship between serviteur, loi, and land that marks the phenomenon of possession. The embodiment of a loi in the body of a servitor that is the cornerstone of Vodou as a belief system. During possession, the possessed, the horse, in this case the woman, gives his or her voice to the spirit, articulating the reciprocal abiding of human and God and making communication between the world of the spirits and that of humans possible. In Papa's account, Possession, August captures this ritualized reciprocity through the mirror-like elements that articulate the link between the two figures, the loi and the woman he has possessed. The reciprocity, evident in their mirroring positions, is underscored by their matching jugs, as Papa Zakat readies to pour the contents of his into hers. The exchange could be of seeds, water, the clairon, or local rum favored by the loi, or of the ashe, or power in the state of pure energy, as Miguel Barnett has defined it. Auguste contextualizes this, his representation of possession, not by placing his reciprocal figures within the ceremonial space of the umfo or temple, but by using the backdrop of the eroded and deforested Haitian landscape as the means of emphasizing the need for Papa Zaka's intervention to help the Haitian land recover its fertility. The leafless and truncated trees in the foreground, the stump of a tree at the lower left corner, and the denuded and deforested hills in the background all point to Haiti's devastating ecological dilemma. Possession, as illustrated by Auguste, has the ultimate goal of practical intervention in solving Haiti's environmental dilemma. The painting underscores that the ultimate goal of successful sacred forms rests in the loi's successful intervention in the resolution of the problem plaguing the mortals who serve them. In other words, like in Francilia's song, can't you see the misery we're going through? I would like us to retain this image in our mind's eye, or maybe here through the technological wonders of PowerPoint. Here, if I don't cover it with my hands. As we turn to the impact of the earthquake of 2010 on religious practices in Haiti, I would like to offer two examples of how the new crisis ushered by the January 2010 earthquake shows the vulnerability of poor post-colonial peoples like those of Haiti, living in deeply compromised environment. One, how the environmental crisis has been linked to the development of Haiti's cholera epidemic, and how the earthquake and to a lesser extent the epidemic have affected that vital relationship between loi, serviteur, and the land in Haiti. Haiti's decreasingly fertile Artibonite Valley, another extremely vulnerable space, offers the most substantial hope for some measure of food security in Haiti, despite its slow recovery from the 2008 floods and in spite of Monsanto's efforts to flood the area with the wretched, genetically altered, non-reproducing horrors. Monsanto makes me want to kind of vibrate. In the aftermath of the earthquake, over 160,000 Haitians were forced to resettle temporarily in the Artibonite, an increase in the regional population that has drained resources and compounded challenges in the removal of waste. Prior to the earthquake, much of the population of the Artibonite, and indeed all of Haiti, lacked access to clean water and adequate waste management systems. Waterborne diseases, as you know if you go to Haiti, are very common. Fears of outbreaks such as that of cholera had been expressed within hours of the January 2010 earthquake. Bacteria such as the one that can cause cholera can breed best among malnourished, poor populations that are already vulnerable to malaria and tuberculosis, both of which are endemic in Haiti. I don't think anyone contemplated the possibility that the bacteria could be introduced by foreign relief troops, but there we are. Ethan Budiansky, however, writing recently in a kind of one of those quick articles for the Huffington Post, has argued for us to consider Haiti's deep deforestation as one of the central causes of the spread of the epidemic. When there aren't enough trees, as it's the case in Haiti, the soil becomes hard-packed, is Budiansky's argument, reducing its ability to absorb water during heavy rains. Hillsides become eroded, sending sediment into streams and lakes. Stagnant pools of water form that are havens for bacteria. Since Haiti lacks reliable drinking water sources in many areas, or most areas, residents tend to rely on these contaminated streams, ponds, and lakes for their water source. Streams that once flowed high enough 10 years ago, and I'm talking about streams that if when you went to Haiti, you know they would come to my chest, for example, if I was trying to cut across, and were used for drinking and bathing, are now slow trickles to the deforestation in the island. You can see in just the last 3 decades, which is about the time I've been going to Haiti, how rivers have... I go back and start looking for a place, and I say, well, when you cross the river, but I can't find the river. You know, the river is no longer there, or I cross a little trickle of water, and I think, no, the river is there, but there is no river. I just passed it 7 miles before. The bacteria that cause cholera and other diseases spread quickly as untreated diarrhea gets into water sources, and this is what's happening in... Everybody's now dependent on the Artibonite because it's the largest river found. So it's not like there's so many rivers, and if one is contaminated, others are not. We are facing a situation here where the sources for water are dwindling. You have two problems in Haiti: the concentration of waters in the Artibonite, and the flooding of the Artibonite caused by Hurricane Thomas, which only worked to spread the bacteria far and wide, making ponds, forming ponds and temporary little rivers that people were getting water from. The double blow of earthquake and cholera was articulated almost immediately in the press through its impact on the nature of belief in Haiti. Visiting Port-au-Prince in August 2010, I was shocked above all by the silence of the drums, by the relative absence of signs that were commonplace before of faith in action. I did see some rara groups, particularly on the weekends, going around town, but not much else. During the entire visit, I only saw one UNFO being prepared for a gathering of believers, and that was in Croix de Bouquet. When religious songs soared in the air of the numerous tent camps, it was chiefly that of Protestant hymns about the salvation provided by Jesus, and it was principally through deafening loudspeakers. On the day of the quake, Haitian film director Jacques Hawk would remark during that visit, and I quote, "Jesus was the most popular spirit in Haiti." This is not to say that the gods of Haiti have gone completely underground, that they have gone on bad law since there are many ready to invoke their names, as they did in the state funeral of Haitian musician Azor of Kazim Mapu. I don't know if you know the group, who died after performing during the annual pilgrimage to Sodo. But questions arise of what has happened to the vital connection that Auguste conveys so economically in this painting. In the weeks immediately following the earthquake, a battle of sorts ensued, played chiefly in refugee camps, between Voodoo practitioners and Christian missionaries, many of them provided with ample capacities for much-needed disaster aid. Félix Germain, in a recent article about Christian missionaries in Haiti, has pointed out, and I quote, how missionary endeavors in Haiti, and for that matter throughout the poverty-stricken global South, capitalize on material deprivation and insecurity to advance their theological agenda. Overtly or covertly, they trade food, services like education and healthcare, water, and even emotional and psychological support for their God. Christians have spearheaded international disaster relief in Haiti and elsewhere in the developing world for decades. Baptists, Catholics, Jehovah's Witnesses, Scientologists, Mormons, and other missionaries have flocked to Haiti in droves since the quake, feeding the homeless, treating the injured, and preaching the gospel in squalid camps where some 1 million people still live. The presence and role of missionaries in Haiti is undeniable. Most passengers in the American Airlines flights between Miami and Port-au-Prince seem to be affiliated with some religious group. You know, it's like, turn left, turn right, somebody's... And then you can they recognize them because they all have the same T-shirts, and you know, they all are so cheerful, and good, so friendly. It's just like, you know, and their impact can be felt on those whose pre-earthquake religious behavior had already gravitated to evangelical Christianity. The earthquake, I'm just quoting from someone, the earthquake is a warning from God to all those witch doctors, letting them know what he can, what he will do, said Michel Nandi Henri, 26, an evangelical Christian to a New York Times reporter. She continued, all the spirits have a leader, that's Lucifer. The struggle for the hearts and souls of the Haitian people have led many to convert before the earthquake. An epidemic severely shifted the religious panorama in Port-au-Prince. So conversions are not new. The estimate is now that about a third of the Haitian population is Protestant. People still keep thinking, quoting that Haiti is what 90% Catholic, 98% Catholic, and 100% Voodoo. That is not so much the case. As Germain argues, and I quote, besides claiming that Voodoo has no spiritual foundation and in fact anger God, who unleashed his fury in the form of the earthquake, many Christian leaders embrace a discourse criticizing the socio-psychological foundation of the Afro-Haitian belief system, asserting that it actually promotes fatalism. In other words, in addition to being the cause of the earthquake, they claim that Voodoo may also hinder the recovery effort. The most fundamental change in this panorama is the wedge now existing between Haiti's Protestant religions, one radically different from the relationship between Catholicism and Voodoo, for example. As Christian groups make inroads among shaken Voodoo followers, some drawn by the steady flow of aid through evangelical missions and others frightened by the disaster they saw as a warning from God. The post-earthquake missionaries, especially the Pentecostals and what is known as the New Evangelicals, have built upon the work dating back to the early 1990s of the evangelist whose strategy is based on spiritual mapping. You heard of spiritual mapping? Which is literally the mapping using anthropological work as its foundation of what particular spirits are worshipped in particular areas, so you can then target those beliefs specifically. And the target of the spiritual mapping is actually to encourage mass conversions, you know, not just individuals, but whole communities. There's a very interesting article by Elizabeth McAllister on this subject, which I would recommend to those interested. As Max Beauvoir, Haiti's leading voodooist, explains, and I quote, people see rice being distributed in front of churches, and those homeless now needing papers are being offered baptism certificates that can act as identity documents, which is also very important. You can prove who you are with a baptism certificate that the churches are giving. The horrible thing, and I continue his quote, though, is that by rejecting voodoo, these peoples are rejecting their ancestors and history. Voodoo is the soul of the Haitian people. Without it, the people are lost. But one of the things McAllister argues very compellingly is how the Pentecostal and the neo-evangelist groups have actually managed to turn that story of Bois Caiman and the foundations of the religion as because it included blood sacrifice and so forth. They killed a pig, which is something that we Caribbean people do all the time. And we actually make stuff with the blood, which is like delicious stuff. But to them, I mean, what can I tell you? But I mean, the whole history of the foundation of Haiti state, it is compromised in the process. It gets it has been turned around. So the Bois Caiman ceremony was a pact with the devil. And every time you worship the Loi, you are essentially dedicating yourself to that pact. I mean, it's a powerful redirection of a kind of radical re-imploding of a very important plot, narrative plot in the history of Haiti. His claim, or Beauvoir's claim, is supported by numerous interviews in the press. The earthquake scared me, said Veronique Malot, 24, who joined an evangelical church 2 weeks before this interview, which was in 2011. When she found herself living in one of the city's many outdoor camps. Vodou has been in my family, but the government isn't helping us. The only people giving aid are the Christian churches. The younger Protestants, as Felix Germain argues, who most likely were indoctrinated by their parents or their missionaries, display a particular strong aversion for Vodou. I'm missing... observed by Paisley Dodd of the New York Times, can escalate into mob violence. Indeed, Dodd notes that in Port-au-Prince's slums, a crowd of seemingly young protesters attacked a group of Vodou practitioners. And this happened in the summer following the earthquake, and I quote, they pelted them with rocks and halted a ceremony meant to honor victims of last month's deadly earthquake. So this was February. Vodouists gather in Cité Soleil, where thousands of quake survivors live in tents and depend on food aid. Praying and singing, the group was trying to conjure spirits to guide lost souls when a crowd of evangelicals started shouting. Some threw rocks, while others urinated on Vodou symbols. When police left, the crowd destroyed the altars and Vodou offerings of food and rum. Beauvoir, the Ati, or supreme leader of Haitian Vodou, underscores the connection made by these militant Protestants between Vodou and the cholera outbreak, a link that led at the beginning of the epidemic to the murders of 45 Ungans and Mambos in Haiti, hacked to death by machetes. As he explained in an interview with Reuters, and I quote, they are being blamed for using Vodou to contaminate people with cholera. The killers, he added, had accused Vodou priests of spreading cholera by scattering powders or casting spells, and complained that local police and government officials were not doing enough to halt the lynchings and punish the killers, although Vodou is recognized and protected by the Constitution as one of Haiti's principal religions. More recently, remarks by President Michel Martelly have fueled the hopes of Protestant groups seeking the state's aid in combating Vodou. On May 6, 2012, at a Protestant conference in Delma, a suburb of Port-au-Prince, Martelly vowed to, and I quote, rededicate Haiti to Jesus of Nazareth. The remarks were taken by Protestant groups as a promise of aid in changing Vodou's official status, although today there have been no indication that Martelly's remarks represent a threat to the band that the evangelists seek. Nevertheless, the Protestant leadership has requested, this happened on the 6th of May of last year, so the anniversary is next Monday. Nevertheless, the Protestant leadership has requested that the 6th of May, next Monday, and then from then on every year, become a day of prayer and rededication to the cause of continuing the grand struggle to change the Haitian mentality and end the reign of darkness, the reign of the devils. In this climate of violence, there have been rays of hope in moments of public affirmation and epiphanies that point to the fact that the reciprocal relationship between loi and servitor that Auguste encapsulates so simply in his painting has not completely vanished. One has been, as I mentioned before, the public funeral in Port-au-Prince's Champ de Mars for Azor, a mass wake presided over by Michel Martelly, this is before his remarks, which filled the entire area of the Champ with its importance as a national symbol with the drums and songs of Vodou. Equally important has been the affirmation of the annual pilgrimage to Sodo on July 16th, the day of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, a veneration of the Virgin and Ursuli fused into a unique ritual. This pilgrimage to the waterfall at Sodor also marks a celebration of the waters and of curative baths that are essential to Vodou. Among the descriptions from believers that appeared in the press during the celebrations in 2011, I want to single one out. The narrative of an epiphany like Auguste's painting gathers the transformation that makes faith possible. The article describes a young woman singing to the waters, and I imagine her like Francilia singing to the waters that bring down the ashe of the spirits onto the bathers. And I quote, "The spirit that is here in the yard, come and grant me my chance." This is her thing. "Erzuli Freda, bring me luck. If there is a spirit in the yard, I will name its name and adore it." As she sang, and this is described in this article, as she sang, the pitch of her voice began to crack. She seemed to be in a trance, her light body falling onto the rocks. As others watched, now believing that Erzuli had possessed her, revelers rushed to her side, whispering their demands in her ears, sure that they were speaking to the goddess, sort of sure that something like this had happened in the waters. The touching simplicity of this transformative act of faith reminds us of the enduring strength of the Lua and their ability to instill hope in a beleaguered population. And I think of Francilia's faith and Augustus' reciprocity as we see it here. The fight to preserve Vodou as the glue that holds Haiti together, as many have described it before, is being waged against forces sustained by a rewriting of Haiti's historical narrative, a superior grounding in anthropology than the normal person walking the streets, and more importantly, deep coffins in the USA's religious movement. Let's hope that the warrior spirits are ready for battle as Haiti's environmental collapse, its resulting epidemics, is nearing a point of massive extinctions, as scientists warn us, are really preparing the grounds for a mighty battle between Luas and the true God of the evangelical faith. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa, for that incredibly rich talk.
Oh, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you like it. I hope you like it because it's coming to you at some point.
I'm sure there's lots of questions. So we've got time for questions and discussion.
The invasion of Christians in Haiti. How would you assess their aims? There's a tendency that's been there forever that they go into the poorest countries and make everybody Christian and believe them.
I think it has to do with propitiating the second coming of Christ. With spiritual mapping, essentially, the idea is that you really need... One of the things speaking of Haiti in particular, one of the ideas that is presented in evangelical religions... if you're asking how I know this, it's because my sister is a devout evangelical and is actually co-pastor of her own church, the Church of the Fountain of the Living Waters. I love her. She's my sister. She ain't heavy. She's my sister. She's a pain in the neck, but it's another matter. So essentially, as my sister has instructed me in her efforts at conversion, what happens with the spiritual mapping is that the more people in Haiti, at some point, the more people that are converted into Christianity and are praying and are dedicated their prayers to a reversal of that path with the devil, the more likely it is to be reversed, and then Haiti's luck will change and things will become fruitful and good and whatever, which we know won't be impossible no matter what intercession of the spirits, unless the spirits actually come down with tops of topsoil and more trees. But that's that is a scientific argument to counter this. So it has to do with changing the energy of the world, the more people that are converted. This is why you don't want to convert Anthony here or, you know, Sherry, you or Michael. You know, you want mass conversions because the mass conversions really are there to shift the balance. And the more the world goes towards this more fundamental Christianity, the faster the second coming of Christ will take place. So I mean, it's a very simplistic way of expressing it, but it is, you know, very compelling in poor countries. So if you need more of the world's population to convert, it is a lot simpler to convert people, especially if you do spiritual mapping and you know precisely what the spirit. If you know that a community in Haiti is dedicated to Papa Zaka or Lokoana Yizan are very big there, then you actually, because in some of these neo-evangelist relationships, they actually take this loi seriously. These loi are spirits against which, you know, the Episcopalians don't really recognize these spirits as spirits that need to be fought against. But the neo-evangelists actually take these spirits seriously and target. It's like targeting the fight. I mean, it's a very interesting development. There's a great article, as I said, by Elizabeth McAllister, and it's called something about, you know, it's worth taking a look at. And I mean, I have it. If anybody, I have a PDF that I can send people if they're really interested, because it's really, really very good. And she actually, one of the things that she does is that she actually traces the how through emails, the media, I mean, the websites of religious organizations in the United States. They have shifted the narrative of Haiti's origins towards this pact with the devil. So when this idiot Robinson, the guy that said, you know, that, well, Haiti had a pact with the devil, the American preacher, said that within a couple of days of the earthquake, he was not making it up. He was actually referring to a narrative that had been very common. But I mean, this is Elizabeth McAllister's research. I don't want to take credit for it. I just, you know, if you're interested in how that narrative was replotted, Liz really does a very good job of, I mean, as her work is usually excellent. So this is a very good way of mapping it. It's very good.
Yeah. So they're basically playing a numbers game that is going to lead to sort of recolonization of Haiti, basically.
Well, saving. I tend, because I'm very non-religious, not non-religious, I grew up Catholic, Voodoo, Santeria, Espiritismo, these are stuff I've lived with all my life. I'm Puerto Rican, this is has shaped up all my life. I went to the Santero or the Espiritista when I was a child as frequently as I went to the doctor and whatever. So to me, this is a continuum of belief, but I think it comes from being Catholic. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an easier way of being Catholic and still believe in other religions. And I think what happens with the Protestantism or the more evangelical branches is that it's one thing or the other. For example, just to tell you a little personal anecdote, my sister fears for me presenting a paper like this because by talking about voodoo, I am aligning myself with the devil. This is, even presenting a paper about that is actually forming part of that pact with the devil. Speaking positively of Wadun is reinforcing that Wakaiman devil pact. So she fears for my soul every time I talk about this. I love her. I mean, it's just completely different worldviews. And so I don't know if it would be a recolonization. I I worry that the Lua are fighting against a very powerful enemy. It's what I, you know, I hope they're ready for it. But with Catholicism, you didn't worry. It was possible to be Catholic and, you know, and practice Vodou. For example, I worry about the material culture of Haiti's Vodou. You know, the beautiful sequin flags, all that beauty of material culture that some of it belongs in museums. You know, I'm thinking of the flags of somebody like Clotaire Basile or whatever. That if you are converting to Pentecostal Christianity or some sort of neo-evangelical group, you actually have to bring your stuff and burn it. So you know, these are acts of material culture destruction that worry me. You impoverish the population. You know, there is a lot of beauty in Haitian homes that comes from chromolithographs of the beautiful paintings on the Lua, on graffiti, or you know, on walls. This is all being painted over. You know, you could go 30 years ago and photograph these beautiful murals on the sides of buildings, bars, you know, like the tap-tap buses and whatever, and that is all disappearing, you know. And one of the worrisome things also is that the Haiti's political leadership is being made up in, you know, in great part by people who are very prominent in the Pentecostal or neo-evangelical field. I mean, it's just a change. I mean, people should be able to believe in whatever, you know, who am I to dictate, whatever, but it's a shift that I think needs marking, and one where both the environmental catastrophe and the earthquake, so you have here an environmental catastrophe and an earthquake, both contributing to the erosion of a religion that has actually guided the nation through many years. So, yeah.
Just extending this, I'm interested. You made the case for the Lua being connected with the land kind of ideology, and I think the implication of what you talked about with these Christian movements is that they're disconnected. They're very much about spiritual change. Has there been an environmental response or movement growing in Haiti that's secular or religious that's come out of?
Well, right now, like, everybody seems to be doing something environmental in Haiti. It's really interesting because at one point during this whole post-earthquake, at first there was no mention of the environmental catastrophe. But I think there are a lot of scientists. I'm thinking of, for example, the work of Eric Calais, who was doing the disaster preparedness project in Haiti, and others. There have been a lot of scientists in Haiti, particularly geologists that just sort of went in and I mean, when I went to Haiti right after, well, not right, but in the summer after the earthquake, I was traveling with a geologist. And one of the things that I mean, he went and did my things, and I went and did his things. And one of the things he wanted to know, there had been a small tsunami in the area in southwest Haiti. So there had been a small tsunami. You could actually see what had happened with the runoff. You know, the mud had actually collected under the coast. You could see this white kind of blur because the topsoil was underwater. The weight of that topsoil actually collapsed during the earthquake, allowing for a small tsunami to come in. It was very small, but he does tsunamis, so we went to do that. But what happened is that there were all these scientists in Haiti. There was a lot of money from the NSF, the National Science Foundation, in the wake of the earthquake. That's who paid for my stay there I was there to kind of teach the scientists about cultural nuances, and talk to, kind of let them know that they couldn't do this without talking to this one or whatever. So it was really interesting to see how, at one point, that information got to the Clinton group, the Clinton Foundation, that has a lot of money from the money that was pledged. A lot of it is being controlled by the Clinton group, and that has actually turned a lot of money towards the environmental. And it is interesting because there is this counter argument, and if there is a balance from to the religious discourse, it's actually the scientists that are getting a lot of attention, and IT Livered publishes a lot of scientific information, which actually counters the notion that this was God's punishment. Now, where is Vodou in that? One of the problem with the foundations of Vodou was there before because of the connection to the Lacou. People have left the land, and the land is no longer productive and so forth. But that was the land where their ancestors were buried. That is the land where everybody returned to honor the Lua in yearly ceremonies and so forth. And those connections had been in some ways slow to be redeveloped in the urban UNFO of Port-au-Prince. So yes, the deforestation, the crisis of the land had actually presented a serious problem for Vodou faith. So when you have this restructuring of the narrative, that every disaster that Haiti endures is God's punishment, and the more people accept Jesus of Nazareth as their savior, the more the land will restore itself. It's quite a powerful one, because it's linked to the environmental catastrophe. It is not, we know it's not true. There are places. I mean, Amy Willens, when writing A Rainy Season, and the rainy season was 1980s. And The Rainy Season is probably 30 years old as a text. She actually narrates, people never think of Rainy Season as an environmental assessment of Haiti, but that's what it is. Rainy Season is about the environment. It's the first book. Everybody says, oh, we discovered the environmental crisis through Jared Diamond's collapse. No. Jared Diamond quotes Emily, and sometimes doesn't quote her. It's Amy Willens' work. What does she tell us there? And this is 30 years ago, that there are places in Haiti where CARE, which had a tree replanting project, where they would plant the trees, and the tree, a mango tree that is supposed to, whatever, would only grow to about this much. Why? Because they discovered that there was not enough topsoil left on the ground to actually give the tree a space for putting together a root system that would allow it to grow more than that. So this is in the, this is Amy Willens 30 years ago. I mean, maybe not 30, but 28 or something. But it's quite, Rainy Season is 1980s, right? And it was already there. So this is not a new crisis. But the larger presence of the Pentecostals, the neo-evangelicals, have actually, it's almost like pitted two armies together. On the one hand, this is all the pact with the devil. You cannot worship the Lua. They're all creating the problem. On the other side is the believers, the people who go to Sot Do and see this woman singing, Exuli, if you are here, come to succor me, bring me some luck, help me. And these people pouring to her and saying, oh my God, it is Exuli, she has been possessed, let's go whisper in her ear our prayers. So there is that faith that comes from culture and atavistic notions of what the history of the country is and how it is rooted in Vodou. And it comes from scientists that are preparing the other discord that says, hey, this is beyond the help of God, unless, of course, instead of raining manna from heaven, he sends topsoil. Should be nice. I'll believe if that happens. You know, I'll switch. But, you know, I don't know. So, yeah.
I was just wondering if there's a kind of danger of over-validating the neo-evangelicals as a kind of independent force. Yeah. You were talking at one point about the money that they bring.
Yeah.
And it's reminded me of quite a few of the analyses around West Africa and the growth of those churches that are really about kind of making money now.
Yes.
Which links in with a lot of the traditional religions. It's not actually completely opposed to those religions. That's why in some ways it's so forceful, because it links in with ideas of being able to do this for the spirit, and then the spirit will give you that.
Yes.
The idea that a preacher can then say, well, you can do this for God, and do this for Jesus, and the kingdom he is.
It's
strong there. And I can imagine that it's also that these evangelical religions, when they begin to take hold and really begin to invest in the place, they will begin to make links, informal links, with voodoo. It won't be quite as, it might still be in its formal discourse and very opposed, but in its informal lived experience, they'll intertwine and merge, and it will become more contested.
I think it will, but it's too early for that, because right now the Haiti, you know, as all of Latin America, I mean, Latin America, there is an ongoing invasion, and this is very well financed, you know, and there's quite a number of studies, because it's a global movement, you know, this is one, I think, of the attractions of the new evangelicals, Pentecostals, that are there offering a connection to a larger system. And Elizabeth McAllister traces this very beautifully by actually tracing people who have gone to train in the United States. You know, my sister goes to Connecticut to a church to train all the time. There is this kind of cosmopolitan connections. And you are right. I think that once these churches get creolized, everything gets creolized in the Caribbean. And why should these churches be any different? You know, once they kind of relax and say, we have defeated the enemy, then the defeated enemy can be incorporated. Yeah, the defeated, you know, it's what they call in Spanish, las tretas del débil, the strategies of the weak. You know, you defeat the and you relax, and then everything gets creolized in the Caribbean. Nothing has ever really survived the Caribbean push towards creolization. So you're right. I think this is very early. And one could relax and say, just give it time. They'll be worshiping Papa Zaka in 30 years. But for the moment, it's very compelling to also the simplification of the lua. You know, it's another type of lua. But also, I worry about the material culture. I worry about the denigration of practitioners. I worry about persecution, violence, abuse of practitioners. I worry about the fact that Vodou had a real struggle to be recognized as one of the main religions of Haiti. All that, that creolization, which is very positive, will come at the expense of a lot of people. Plus, they don't believe that what they're offering is empty of a promise. I mean, I believe, and maybe because I have a sister I love and she's really into this, that it's very sincere. It's, you know, that none of these people are hypocritically going there and saying, let's just get some more money coming to the church, or we can sell more Bibles or whatever. You know, this is not really a group of people that are mercenary, although perhaps the larger organizations are indeed quite mercenary. But the people you see in the planes are happy go, I'm here for Christ. You know, they're good people. The armies, you know, the brass may be mercenary, but these are essentially very good people that are providing very important services for Haiti, even if they have an agenda. The problem is that what they're promising also is not providable. You know, if they were promising something they could deliver, I would feel a little better. But in promising something that is undeliverable, they are destroying part of the legacy, the visual cultural legacy of Haiti. They are changing the landscape. You go to Haiti now, and there are all these Christian billboards everywhere, and you go like, oh no, what is that? You know, come to Jesus or whatever. So you know, there is money because billboards, you know. But there's also a reshifting of the economy in Haiti where you have a new elite that because in some ways these religions are very, very much about empowerment and enrichment in this world. They are not the kingdom of, you know, they are not looking for rewards in the kingdom of heaven, Catholicism is, blessed are the poor, because, you know, and whatever, then the eye of the needle, you know, if you're... No, these people see the blessing of God as measured in material possessions and, a better economic situation in the kingdom of this world. It's really Creolized. Yeah, you stick around in the Caribbean and you get Creolized. That's, you know. But in the meantime, I think there are dangers to Haiti's culture, art, you know, material culture, and violence and suffering. And a battle, you don't want civil strife in a already beleaguered nation. When I end by talking about battle, there is battle, and if there's battle, there's violence, and they have God, and the USA, and the Marines on their side. So, do I sound paranoid enough? I'm paranoid. I'm sorry. Totally paranoid. Any others?
There's nothing, we should probably head to a break before the next page.
Thank you very much. Thank you.